welcome to the Plunkett Cootie BYOD webinar. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Mr. John Cornwell. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is John Cornwell, and I'm Plunkett Cootie's Practice Development Manager, and we're really pleased to have all of you with us today for this important discussion about technology use in the workplace. I have the pleasure of coordinating today's webinar, and it's part of our Informed Employer webinar series sponsored by Plunkett Cootie's Labor and Employment Practice Group. Before we begin, I want to take just a couple of moments to provide you with some background about the firm and today's speaker. Plunkett Cootie is based in Southeast Michigan, is one of the Midwest's oldest and largest law firms. We have about 160 attorneys today, and we have 9 offices in Michigan and 1 office each in Columbus, Ohio, and Indianapolis, Indiana. The firm's employment law practice group includes more than 20 attorneys who practice primarily in such areas as traditional labor law, human resources consulting, and employment litigation. Today's webinar actually has been approved for 1.25 general recertification credit hours toward PHR, SPHR, and GPHR recertification through the HR Certification Institute. A certificate of completion will be emailed to each of you early next week reflecting that credit. So if you don't need the credit and you receive the PDF, simply disregard it. At this time, I'd like to introduce you to our featured speaker today, and it is attorney Courtney Nichols from the Employment Law Practice Group. And Courtney is a member of our Bloomfield Hills office, and she focuses her litigation practice primarily in the area of employment law, with emphasis on discrimination and retaliation claims, whistleblower disputes, and civil rights law. Courtney also represents and advises employers on important employment issues involving various state and federal statutes, including ELCRA, FEMLA, ADA, FLSA, and Title VII. So now for a couple of quick housekeeping notes before we get started. If you're still attempting to log into our webinar provider, startvisuals.com, and you're having any difficulties, please be sure to turn off your pop-up blocker software. And due to the volume of callers we have today attending, we are going to have a question and answer, operator-assisted question and answer session at the end of the program. At the end, Courtney will take as many of the questions you have as time permits, and our operator will come back on the line and tell you how to go about asking that question so that it's for the benefit of everybody on the call. And please note that today's session is being recorded, and both the audio file and the presentation slides will be available soon on Plunkett Cootie's website, which is located at www.plunkettcootie.com. I ask you to have a little bit of patience with us. We're actually going through a website upgrade right now, so it may be a couple days before that information is posted. So my apologies for that delay. So once again, on behalf of the firm, thanks very much for attending the webinar. And now I get to turn the program over to Courtney Nichols. Courtney.
Thanks, John, and thank you all for attending today. The first thing I want to do is give you a brief overview about what we're going to be speaking about during the course of this webinar. So really, it's going to be 3 things. To get started with, what is BYOD? It's an acronym that we'll be using throughout this presentation, and it's an acronym that you may or may not have heard, but it's something that you definitely will be hearing in the future. The second thing we're going to discuss is what are the risks of BYOD in employment today? Those risks are quite varied, as you will shortly see. And last, but most importantly, we're going to talk about what you and your company can do as far as policies and practices to protect yourself when you're dealing with the risk inherent in a BYOD employment setting. And we'll be talking about those at the end as well as throughout the presentation. So with that said, let's get started and move into the substance here. What is BYOD? It's the use of employee-owned mobile devices such as smartphones and tablets to access business enterprise content or networks. And as you can see, there's a cartoon with a reference to what we've commonly heard as BYOB. Now we have BYOD, which is quite different, but I guess equally as dangerous in some respects. So the big issue here with BYOD is that employees can work virtually anywhere with tablets, laptops, and smartphones. It's really common. You see it all the time. I'm pretty much addicted to my iPhone. I can't imagine being separated from it for more than an hour or two while awake. It allows companies to be more efficient, and it allows employees to be more connected to the work. And it's becoming more and more common for people to have one device. So a few years ago, BlackBerries, when they were really prevalent, you would see a lot of individuals with a personal phone and then a BlackBerry for work. Well, now we're seeing iPhones, we're seeing Androids, we're seeing those be used for both purposes. So there's really a blurring of the line, which is causing a lot of the issues that we're going to talk about today to arise. So when we talk about BYOD and why we're having this presentation today, why are we talking about this topic when it seems, you know, somewhat abstract? Well, because it's not going anywhere. It's getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Market researcher Gartner Incorporated predicts that almost 4 in 10 organizations will rely exclusively on BYOD by 2016, and 85% will have some kind of BYOD program in place by 2020. So the vast majority are going to be relying upon allowing their employees to use their own personal devices to do work business. Currently, there are nearly twice as many personally used iPhones, iPads, and Android devices than their corporate-issued counterparts. So we're already seeing that shift that I just touched upon from where, you know, we had BlackBerries to now we have iPhones or Androids, and they're being used for both purposes. There are a couple other stats that aren't listed on this slide that I wanted to talk with about you today. According to Cisco, 51% of users connect to unsecured wireless networks with their smartphones. So when we talk about risk, there we go. Over 50% are using their personal device to connect to unsecured wireless internet connections. Employees will also spend an average of $965 a year on their devices and $734 a year on their internet data plans. So employees are spending upwards of $1,800 out of pocket to have a personal device they're doing work-related business on. In 2015, it's estimated that there'll be 2 billion smartphones worldwide. So again, just huge, huge, huge implications in amount of people using these devices. Another important leading trend that I want to talk to you about that's probably really applicable to many of you on the call today is that BYOD is being championed by small and medium-sized businesses. Those are the entities that are using BYOD more so than large corporate, huge corporate clients, because they can benefit from the efficiencies and the cost savings that BYOD practices allow them to have. Some of the advantages of a BYOD program. We're dealing with sophisticated and powerful devices. When you're talking about the new Samsung Galaxy phones, you're talking about the iPhone 5 and what they're probably going to be coming out with here shortly. Extremely efficient and productive devices, far more than some of the more business-centric technology devices that are out on the market today. And because it's consumer-driven, the companies are always pushing themselves to make the technology even more efficient and effective. Employees also have greater opportunities and flexibility when they have access to work on their personal devices. So they have the opportunity to contribute in more ways than ever. You're dealing with family situations where you have to run out of the office, but it's not that big of a deal because you can use your cell phone to clean up on your emails or call in with any last-minute checkups. Another huge benefit of BYOD is that it, frankly, saves money for a lot of companies. You're freeing up IT resources, and you're not having to supply technology. You're not having to pay for BlackBerry for all your employees or for laptops, which can be a huge cost savings. So with that said, you know what BYOD is, you know why companies are doing it, and you know why we're talking about it here today. What are the risks? Why would you steer away from a BYOD policy? And what do you need to be aware of if you already have a BYOD policy or if you're considering implementing a BYOD policy or practice? One of the things I want to do here today is just raise red flags, is make you aware of potential problems, because this is such a new arena that there's a lot out there that hasn't been discussed with companies that are either considering or already are allowing their employees to use their own personal devices. An overview of what the biggest risks are: data security breaches, harassment and discrimination issues, wage and hour issues, and lastly, invasion of employees' privacy. So the first thing I want to talk about is data security breaches. So when you're talking about data security issues, there's several issues. And one of the things I want to say at the beginning of this portion of the presentation is that it's really important to have a tripart relationship at your company between the IT department, HR, and management. It's important because the technology issues that I'm going to discuss, the data security issues, quite frankly, they're over my pay grade insofar as the technology implicated is really sophisticated. So it's important if you have an IT department to just open the door to talk to them about these issues, to see if it's something that they know about, something that they're concerned with, to have that that chain of communication established now so that you don't have an issue later. With that said, some of the biggest issues we see as far as data security, first and foremost, is loss of visibility. So when employees are using company-issued devices, such as a Dell laptop or a BlackBerry phone, it's far easier for IT or management to track and see what is going on in those devices. Now they're using a personal device, which is making them vulnerable to malware and phishing scams, and vulnerable to hackers. Hackers can gain access through applications that employees may be downloading on their personal devices. Even if it's not stolen, which is something that we're going to be talking about, even if we're just talking about a malware issue can be incredibly dangerous to a company. In February of 2012, Juniper Networks reported a 155% increase from 2010 to 2011 in the volume of malicious software created for mobile devices. Some of that malicious software takes the form of apparently innocuous applications downloaded through an app store to the employee's personal device, in particular devices using the Android operating systems. So an employee may just innocently download an application, but that application may have a malware virus implanted in it, which now has given a third party access to that everything going on in that employee's phone, including your business information. So malware is a big issue, something to be concerned about. Another issue is, as you would think, lost or stolen iPhones. That's the one that sticks out and comes to mind. And the statistics support that initial gut feeling. A study done last year returned results that 39% of companies reported that their organization had sustained a data security breach as a result of lost or stolen equipment. So it's common, it happens, and companies are having their data breached as a result of it. In 2011, Lookout, which is a company that provides software to help locate lost or stolen devices, helped 9 million people locate their devices. So that would be about one request in every 3.5 seconds. So that just tells you how common it is for individuals to lose these devices. The issue with BYOD is that if they lose their personal phone, now they might be losing sensitive data. The other issue is, even if we're not talking about lost iPhones or Androids or phones that are hacked into through malware phishing scams, we're talking about sensitive data leaving your building, which is a concern. Oftentimes, that data leaves your building without encryption or other simple security measures. So now the data is available and exposed to theft, loss, or corruption. This is a particular issue for industries under regulatory scrutiny. The two that come to mind are the financial industry and the healthcare industry. Pursuant to the healthcare industry and the HIPAA Act, hospitals, healthcare providers, health insurers, and self-insured health plans are required to implement technical, physical, and administrative safeguards for protective health information that's stored in electronic form. Recently, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services obtained seven-figure settlements in two different matters arising from security breaches. So this is particularly important for healthcare and financial businesses that they ensure their sensitive data. In the healthcare realm, we're talking about patient health information. Same thing in the financial realm. Patient information is properly protected and that you have the safeguards in place ahead of time. What do we do? That's the next question and probably the first question. The first thing is to develop and implement comprehensive policies. This is the first time you've seen that today. It will not be the last, so I'm just going to give you a warning right now. I know that you've heard it from us in our other webinars, but policies are incredibly important, but in no more context than in the BYOD context. The second thing that you can do is give IT some control, and that's where this relationship between management, IT, and HR is really important, is that they need the ability to fix a problem. One way that you can fix the problem is remote device wipes, in particular a selective wipe. And this is what's becoming more and more standard with companies that are using BYOD. And that is a policy that allows a company to wipe only corporate settings, data, and apps. So you're allowing the company to get in there and wipe everything from the phone that might have been stolen or compromised, but not affect the employee's personal data. And that's really a win-win for both. The issue there is that you have to make sure that policy that you have allowing selective wipes is clear, and it says what you're going to allow to be wiped, who's going to wipe it, and when it's going to be wiped. Any ambiguities, as you will hear from me throughout this presentation, will be drafted or will be interpreted against the drafter, so against the company. One other thing that you can do, which is super simple and will be repeated throughout this presentation, is mandate simple security precautions such as device passwords or key locks on personal devices. So if an employee is using an iPhone, for example, you have to have a login password. And you can have a policy that says that. We're allowing you to use your personal device for work-related purposes. However, you have to have it password protected. And follow up on it and ensure that that's happening, because that will prevent potential form of data security breach, which is a lost phone being picked up and accessed. Another thing that you can do is implement external off-site backup systems for user data based on data classification and sensitivity. And this is something that you're going to have to talk to IT about. But basically, this is just making sure it's all backed up. So if something is lost or corrupted, you have another copy of it. So you're not relying upon an employee who's using a phone for personal and business uses to be the sole protector of important company information. Another thing is network security. Network enforced passwords that should be rotated on a periodic basis. So this is an example of where an employee has to log in to access the network. Many companies are doing this, and this is something that we would recommend, which is you require that password to be changed frequently, so every month or every quarter. So if their password is somehow subject to being stolen or hacked, that it will not expose the company as a whole, and that you're just requiring that to be updated and make sure that its special characters are included and that there's a minimum password length so that it's not as susceptible to corruption. Finally, you have to do this, as I will discuss, educate employees with access to confidential data. This is really, really important because of the Trade Secrets Act, which has been codified here in Michigan. It's referred to as the Michigan Uniform Trade Secrets Act. If you call data confidential but did not tell anybody it is confidential, it is really not confidential. So the key here is that if something's stolen and accessed and misappropriated and you want to be able to bring a claim after the fact, you have to make sure that you have the first requirement of that claim met, which is that the data is actually confidential. And when we're talking about what is confidential under the Uniform Trade Secrets Act, there's three factors that the courts are going to look to. Those aren't listed on the PowerPoint, but I'll explain them to you here. The first factor is the actual extent of measures taken by the employer to guard the secrecy of the information. If you don't tell your employees what information is confidential, then you haven't really taken any measures to guard the secrecy of that information. So you'll probably be out right there. The second thing that courts will look to is the extent to which the information is known by others in the same business. And the third thing is the ease or difficulty with which the information can be properly duplicated or acquired by others. So in this context, the first requirement is really important, that there's actual measures that you're taking to guard the secrecy of that information. So now we're going to shift gears here and go to a different risk that's not as technical and probably hits more closely to home to many of you on the call today, and that's harassment and discrimination issues. When we're talking about harassment, first and foremost, employees often believe that using their personal devices places them beyond the employer's purview and insulates them from liability. They may also believe that there's nothing that you can do, so they're insulated and you're insulated. That's a mistaken belief. The other issue with harassment is that you're losing a level of control. 10 years ago when the Internet blew up and we started seeing far more forms of electronic harassment, there was still a level of employer control of blocking certain websites, of monitoring. Now you don't have that level for the reason that we discussed earlier, is that you might not have access to the personal device that you do to the work device. With the result of that, you have employees that might now feel more free to access the content they wouldn't access before because they're not worried about you looking over their shoulder, right? It's the common scenario that when you walk by an employee's desk and they click out of their website as soon as they can because they've been online shopping. Well, now if they have their phone in their lap underneath the table and you walk by the desk, they might just drop it on the ground or slide it underneath their leg. There's not that same concern about, oh, no, they're going to catch me looking at something I shouldn't be looking at. The other big, big issue here is discrimination. First and foremost, when you have employees using their personal devices, you might access information you don't want to have. So, for example, if you do have an agreement with an employee where you're allowed to look at information on their personal device at periodic intervals, you might learn things about them that you don't want to know. For example, the employee might download a diabetes management application or have other information that implicates the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act. Now you've learned that your employee is in a protected category that you didn't know about before, and they might have a basis for a lawsuit that they didn't have before. So we'll talk about these in more depth, but I just wanted to give you an overview of the general issues facing harassment and discrimination in a BYOD context. So with that said, there are a couple of examples that I wanted to talk about in more detail here today. The first example is Blakey versus Continental Airlines Incorporated. And this is a case that came out of New Jersey a couple of years ago. It's an older case, but I think it sheds the light on where we're probably going with regard to the implication of BYOD in the case law in both federal and state courts. So in Blakey, the plaintiff was a female airline pilot for Continental Airlines. Shortly after she became the first female pilot to fly the Airbus A300 aircraft, she complained about a hostile work environment and sexual harassment. The basis of her complaints were that people were posting inappropriate things on an internet message board. And this message board was available for use by Continental employees. It was particularly used by pilots as part of a broader system to manage piloting assignments. The court held that the bulletin board, this online message board, was actually an extension of the workplace, and considered it sufficiently integral to the workplace to affirm the jury verdict in the plaintiff's favor. And one of the things that the court really focused on in that case is that the employer was aware about this harassment, and they didn't do anything to stop it. There was really no action to take because they viewed it as separate and distinct from the workplace. So the number one takeaway point here is that if there's harassment that is sufficiently integral to the workplace, it's going to classify as being within the realm of the employer to remedy. Now, if you're allowing an employee to use their personal device to conduct work, and they're also harassing employees on that personal device, there is a very good chance that a court's going to find that sufficiently integral to be connected to your workplace. The second case that's on the slide also gives us insight into where courts will likely go. This is a case that came out of Orange County, and it's called Espinoza versus the County of Orange. And this was a disability harassment case. What happened here was that a blog was started by an Orange County corrections officer on his own time outside of work. He started this blog in August 2006. Shortly after the blog was up and running, various comments were posted and various blogs authored about the plaintiff's hand and disability. He had a problem with his hand, and they referred to it as a claw. And quite frankly, they were ruthless. They referred to him as a rat. They made sexual comments about his mother. They really didn't hold anything back. The employee complained to his boss about it, complained to the deputy. The deputy sent an email to the employees that he determined were making these blog posts. But what he didn't do was stop employees from accessing the blog during working hours. So while he sent an email and said, "You can't post those things anymore, guys, and knock it off," he didn't cut off their access, so they could access the blog both in work and outside of work. And the jury ended up awarding the plaintiff $820,000, so almost $1 million on that case. And that was affirmed by the Court of Appeals. And one of the key things that the Court of Appeals found was that while there were remedial actions taken, so unlike Blakey, in Orange, they took some remedial actions. they were not sufficient. They were just sort of cursory and illusory remedial actions. So in Orange County, you have this individual who knows how bad this harassment is, but he thinks, okay, I'll tell them to stop and that will be good. No, you're likely going to have to go a step farther. You're going to have to cut off access. You're going to have to figure out how severe it is and proper a remedy that fits that severity, not something that's just illusory and that you think will be a sufficient defense in court. You really got to go above and beyond in these cases. And one of the other key things about County of Orange is that the employer made the argument that the blogs were posted temporarily outside of working hours, a lot of the key discriminatory blogs. That didn't pass muster. So if you have a case with somebody screwing around on Facebook, for example, or Twitter, something like that, and it's after work hours, you still have to look at how is it blending in with the workplace. And if it's on a personal device used for work purposes, it's going to be an even stronger case for the employee. So with that said, it's important that your policies address this, which we'll talk about later. Before we get to that, I want to touch on disability discrimination, which is a form of discrimination that I think most likely going forward is going to implicate employers as far as the BYOD context is concerned. With regard to disability discrimination, I'm just going to take 2 seconds right now to let everybody know on the call that this is probably the number one hot topic area that we're dealing with right now. The EEOC is all about ADA discrimination cases. It's been on their radar for a couple of years, and it's on their enforcement guidance, and they're coming down pretty hard. They're taking hard stances, and the courts are sort of starting to follow suit. So ADA is the one area that we're telling all of our clients, really be careful. Make sure that you're up to date, that you know what's going on, because these lawsuits are incredibly costly given the attorney's fees provision and oftentimes very difficult to win on summary judgment given the standards that are so employee-friendly. So with that said, disability discrimination is also implicated with the BYOD society. The number one way it is that an employee's personal device may be a reasonable accommodation. That simple. An employer may be required to pay for an assistive software on an employee's device or otherwise pay for the device, even if they didn't have a policy of doing so before, if it contained an assistive function necessary for the qualified employee to perform the essential functions of his or her job. And there are 2 examples that we've seen to date that really touch on this. The first is Rojek versus Catholic Charities of Jackson, Incorporated. And just as a disclaimer, unfortunately, none of these cases are from Michigan. They're all from other districts, but they do give us insight into what may be happening here, and I think are still important for employers to be aware of. So with that said, in Rojek, the question was whether the company had to provide a special document reader to a blind applicant who said, I can do everything this job requires, but I just need this bit of technology. And the defendant said no. You know, we can't pay for it. Well, that ended up being a jury question. So that shows you that the employer could not survive summary judgment just by saying it was expensive. They didn't think they needed to go out and buy a special device. The second case, very similar issue, Herring versus Department of Social and Health Services. The jury found that the use of an eyesight assistance viewer to review a training manual was a reasonable accommodation. Same thing, the employer argued it was too expensive. So there's a graphic here, and it's an individual trying to push a rock up a hill titled undue burden, and that's really what it is. If you're going to rely upon an undue burden defense to providing a reasonable accommodation, it's an uphill battle, and you got to make sure that it's actually an undue burden. So if it's something as simple as providing an employee additional technology or allowing use of their device in a way that you didn't before, it's probably going to be a reasonable accommodation 9 times out of 10, and it's something that you would likely need to talk to your attorneys about before, you know, individually making the determination that it's not. Now the question becomes, as it always is, okay, what do we do about it? How do we limit these issues? The first thing is to craft and train supervisors and employees on policies concerning the use and misuse of all electronic resources during work time and on work premises. Almost every company that has a handbook probably has an appropriate use of technology handbook. If you're using BYOD, I would strongly advise that you look and make sure the appropriate use of technology includes appropriate use of personal devices, used for work business and doesn't just say appropriate use of company-issued devices, which is very common language. I would also look at your existing policies to ensure that they cover harassment by coworkers and others for off-duty conduct that may create a hostile work environment. So too often we hear people think that if it's not on duty, it's not our problem. The cases that I talked about earlier are just two examples of many that show that's not necessarily the case. So if your policies don't already do that, I would strongly suggest looking at them to see what you can do to make sure that employees know they can't do these things on their own time or on their own devices while at work and think it's okay. The third thing is to train supervisors and employees on how to recognize accommodation requests. So this is a big issue, period. A lot of times we have lawsuits because an employee has told their supervisor, you know, I have this problem, can you do this for me? The supervisor says no and never takes it up the chain to HR. And nobody knows that the employee has just requested an accommodation, and as a result, the employer is now bound to engage in the interactive process, and the interactive process never happens. That's a big, big issue. So when you're training your supervisors to acknowledge when somebody has made a request for accommodation, make sure they understand that a request to use technology in some form to assist them throughout their day at work is also a request for a reasonable accommodation. Because it's something that might, frankly, seem foreign. I never thought about the possibility of a blind applicant asking for a special reading device to get a job that you would otherwise think of requires somebody to read. But it happens. So it's something that they should be aware of and just on the lookout for. The other thing that they need to do is really understand that reliance on cost-prohibitive, undue burden arguments may not be enough to reject a request for accommodation. This is a situation, if you're going to rely on undue burden, run it by an attorney. Really look at the law and see what that requires, because it's a very difficult burden to meet. And then finally, engage in the interactive process. So what I talked about before, if it's not being reported up the chain, the employer often doesn't have the opportunity to engage in the interactive process. Here, if there's any indication that you've garnered from an employee or from even accessing an employee's electronic information that they need an accommodation to do their essential functions of their job, engage in the interactive process. Don't slam the door on suggestions or thoughts that are based in technology that you think might be a little far-fetched. Make sure that you're engaging in the complete process as you would in any other context. So that pretty much summarizes the hot topic harassment and discrimination issues. Speaking of hot topics, wage and hour issues. So these aren't going anywhere. As I'm sure you all know, the Fair Labor Standards Act is in the media, and it's in the media in a big way because of class action lawsuits. We've seen a significant trend towards class action lawsuits since about 2011, and the trend's not going anywhere. Seems like more and more of these are filed, and they're becoming more and more costly for employers. So we're trying to get out there and let you all know ahead of time what you can do to protect yourself from these class action lawsuits. And one of the ways that we believe class action lawsuits are going to start to materialize is through claims that people did work off of work hours and never got paid for it. Now, how do they do the work? On their personal devices. Just a basic primer on wage and hour issues and what the FLSA and the Michigan Minimum Wage Payment Law requires. Off-the-clock work. If a non-exempt employee uses his or her mobile device to conduct work-related business, there is a risk that the employee will raise a wage and hour claim after the fact for off-the-clock work. Even if the employee's use is voluntary and without directive from the employee must be compensated for time spent making work-related calls or reading and writing emails. Now, that's really key there, is that even if the use is voluntary, even if it wasn't directed, still requires compensation. Also, as you all know, the FLSA requires non-exempt employees to be paid overtime for all hours beyond 40 worked per week. Another key here is that overtime includes, just like other time, all time that employees are suffered or permitted to perform work. So that sounds like, well, maybe volunteerism may fit into that. You know, maybe suffered or permitted. They just picked up an email afterwards, and we never told them they had to pick it up. We didn't suffer them to work, but you permitted them to work. The argument's not going to fly. So if employees are checking emails or doing anything on a personal device, work-related afterwards, it needs to be recorded, and the employee needs to be compensated for that time. another wage and hour issue, although not a big one. This isn't a big issue, but I just wanted to bring it to your attention, is expense reimbursement. The FLSA prevents employers from requiring employees to pay for business expenses of the employer if doing so reduces the employee's earnings below the required minimum wage or overtime compensation. 11 states have expressed or implied statutory expense reimbursement requirements, and Michigan is one of them. So when we're talking about expense reimbursements, this is a pretty rare case, but it's a situation where somebody is expected to use their personal phone to do work business, and they pay for it. And so when you factor in their monthly payment of their phone, their data plan, what have you, and their paycheck, that when you divide it by the hours worked, they're getting less than the minimum wage. So if you're borderline here, I would look into it. But for the vast majority of employers, it's really not that big of an issue, but it's something that you should be aware of. The next slide tells you this statutory language that applies to expense reimbursement, so you can see exactly what we're talking about here, that an employer shall not deduct from employee wages directly or indirectly any amount, including employee contribution to a separate segregated fund, without the full, free, and written consent of the employee, obtained without intimidation or fear of discharge for refusal to permit the deduction. So the analysis is that you're indirectly deducting from their pay the amount of money they're paying for their cell phone device because they're using that cell phone device for work. So, again, rather rare issue. I haven't seen it been an issue for any of my clients yet, but it's something to just be on the lookout if you have borderline employees. So this is the most important part of this portion. How do you limit wage and hour issues? Number one, number one here is really training supervisors to identify off-the-clock work and to not reinforce that behavior. This is what happens in 9 out of 10 cases. The employee sends an email after work hours when he shouldn't be working, and the supervisor responds. The supervisor is reinforcing that behavior. What needs to happen in that situation is when the employee sends the email, the supervisor doesn't respond, and the next day addresses it with the non-exempt employee who should not be working after he punches out by saying, you're not expected to send me emails. I don't want you to send me emails after work hours. And please let me know if there was any additional time you worked yesterday. What that allows the supervisor to do is to make sure that the company has recorded that time and can pay that time. As I'm sure many of you know, in the FLSA context, if an employee is recording time that he or she is working off the clock and the employer does not have records to dispute that, there's an inference arisen that the employee's records are accurate and that there's been a violation of the FLSA because the employer hasn't compensated the employee for all time worked. So the best way for employers to combat that is to have clear records on their end that show all time work, including time worked on BYOD devices after somebody's punched out. Another issue that you can do is implement a policy requiring prior written authorization to work remotely via a mobile device. So this might be something you want to do. It might not be something you want to do. This isn't a must-have policy, but you can definitely instruct employees that unless authorized, all emails should be responded to only during working hours. If you do not want your employees, your non-exempt employees, out there sending emails after they've punched out, then make sure that it's in writing and they know. Manage the expectations ahead of time. What else you need to do is revise leave of absence policies. So this is another area that we see this happening a lot, is that when an employee is out for an extended absence, they check emails or they catch up on work assignments when they're not supposed to be working at all. The thing that you can do to really easily combat that problem when you have a BYOD program is deactivate the employee's connection to the company's data systems and reconfigure the system so that calls or emails are directed to another address, so an automatic forwarding on the email, something as simple as that. I know that several law firms have a program in place where attorneys may access their email remotely, but secretary and other administrative staff cannot. So that might be something that works easiest for your company and something that you need to talk to your IT managers about is how can I segregate my employees so certain employees can have access after hours and others just period cannot. That's a pretty clean way to make sure they're not accessing email and what have you on tablets or laptops after work hours. Another thing that you need to do to protect your company with regard to these wage and hour issues, which is located on the next slide, is talking about what reimbursement method, if this is an issue for you, fits your company, i.e. reimbursement of the actual expenses or a lump sum payment estimated to fully compensate the employees who might be on that borderline of minimum wage if you deduct what they're paying for their phone. The other thing is, this is the number one thing. You got to require employees to track and report all time worked, including any time spent on personal devices after hours. And you can include a policy that requires employees to report all time work, all time spent working outside of the office. So earlier I talked about you may or may not want to do a policy prohibiting them from period ever responding to emails outside the office. This policy might be best for a lot of companies that might need non-exempt employees to occasionally get emails. You can allow it, just make sure it's recorded, and you have to follow up on that. Because the problem that we see in FLSA actions is that if employers aren't on top of the time spent work, that 2 years down the line when one of these class actions is filed, you've been in the dark the entire time. You don't have the records to rebut it. What can you really say? But if you consistently stay on top of these people to make sure that they're reporting to you the time they've worked and you're paying them, you're doing yourself a huge service by preventing a lawsuit down the line and or making a defense far cheaper and easier for your company. So just a general review right now of some of the solutions that we've discussed so far before I get into another issue is a modification of current policies. We talked about them before, but you can go through, if you don't want an entire separate BYOD policy to combat some of these issues, and just make sure that all your policies apply when using BYOD devices. So you have harassment, discrimination, and EEO policies. A simple way to update that is by putting in language, including electronic communications. So right now you probably have something prohibiting, you know, any sexual harassment. You might have examples of that. You can put in there, this includes, you know, verbal discussions and electronic communications. This applies on or off premises when conducting company businesses. Time recording and overtime. You can update that policy to include, you must also include all time worked off company property on your own personal device if using it for company business. Same thing with acceptable use of technology that we talked about before. Update that policy so if it is limited right now to your company platforms, your company computers and phones, but it also applies if they're using personal devices to those as well. Data privacy and security, require passwords. Confidentiality and trade secret protection, make sure that you define what the confidential information is and indicate if it's accessible to employees through their BYOD devices. So moving on, shifting gears slightly here to our last major risk, we have employee privacy concerns. A common mantra for employers is that employees have no reasonable expectation of privacy in any information stored or transmitted through an employer's information systems. That mantra is changing and changing quickly. Employees do have a reasonable expectation of privacy in information stored on a portable device that they own. They do have an interest in privacy, a privacy interest, and their personal emails contained in their personal email accounts. And as a result, employees are starting to have growing concerns regarding invasive BYOD policies, policies that go too far. And the last thing we want is a workforce that thinks the employer is trying to sneak around their back or get something from them that they're not entitled to. So with that said, there's a couple of privacy issues that I want to bring to the forefront today to make you aware of. First and foremost, the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, which is referred to commonly as the CFAA. The CFAA makes it a criminal offense to gain unauthorized access to a computer, permits recovery of civil damages when an authorized access occurs up to $5,000. All 50 states have enacted computer trespass laws, which largely parallel the CFAA. So, again, you cannot gain unauthorized access to a computer. It's really important to make sure that you have consent and clear consent if there's a situation where you want to gain access to an employee's personal device. The second big act that I want to talk about today, and I'm going to talk about in a little bit more detail, is the Stored Communications Act. The Stored Communication Act raises a similar issue as the CFAA. The Stored Communication Act prohibits unauthorized access to email stored at an email service provider. So like the CFAA, that Stored Communications Act is a criminal statute with civil remedies. We do have one decision that provides an example of what might happen in a Stored Communications Act case, and that's contained on the next slide. That case is Pure Power Boot Camp versus Warrior Fitness Boot Camp LLC, and that is a case that's out of New York. In that case, the decision went against the employer. The employer accessed the former employee's Hotmail account using the login credentials that had been stored on the employer's computer system when the employee accessed the account using his work computer. While accessing the employee's Hotmail account, the employer found an email with the password for the employee's Gmail account and decided to go a step further and get into that account as well. The employee sued. So the employee sued, and he obtained summary judgment on his SCA claim. Just cannot be messing around with that stuff without the employee's prior and clear authorization. You're exposing yourself to civil and you're exposing yourself to criminal claims. Another thing that you need to be aware of is if you are relying upon consent, is that the consent has to be absolutely clear, express, and unambiguous. In another case out of New York, Pia Trello versus Hillstone Restaurant Group, which isn't on the slide, but I just wanted to touch on real quick. A district court upheld a jury verdict in punitive damages against an employer for violating the SCA, despite the employer's argument that it had consent. What happened was that the jury found that the employee had been coerced into consenting because the employee testified she thought something bad might happen to her if she didn't allow her supervisor to get access to a password-protected online chat forum that she had created and was using. So in that case, there was evidence that the supervisor sort of put some pressure on this employee to give the consent. It wasn't clear. It wasn't unambiguous. There were problems. So something to keep in mind moving forward. Stored Communications Act and the CFAA. Criminal statutes, civil remedies, very dangerous. How can we avoid these issues that may be criminal and civil in nature? You can reduce the reasonable expectation of privacy. Be as specific as possible with respect to what employees can expect regarding privacy of their personal information on their BYOD device if they're using it for work purposes. So, again, the problems with the other two cases I talked about is that there was a lack of clarity. So you have to be specific here. Ambiguities are going to be resolved against the drafter. That's what the law states. So they'll be resolved against you and in the employee's favor. Identify under what circumstances your company will monitor and or access the employee's device. It says employers there, but it should be employees. If you're going to use some sort of software to access an employee's device or to check what they're doing, they have to be aware of it, they have to understand it, and they should consent to it. Which brings us to the next slide, which is require employee consent prior to allowing use of BYOD devices to perform work. So if you're implementing a BYOD policy or have a BYOD policy, you can require consent as part of allowing the employee to utilize the policy that you have in place. The consent needs to be specific, like we discussed. So, for example, we're going to monitor the device, including the device's stored data and transmissions. We have the ability to remotely wipe the device, which we talked about before. We can install security software to manage the device, and we can copy data to meet litigation hold and retention requirements. So if you're specific about the things that your company might be doing, you can defeat some of those privacy claims. With that said, I want to finish today by reviewing some of our solutions and some of the appropriate policy language that we've touched on, as well as some other sample language that you might want to implement in your policy. So first and foremost, one of the solutions is, in addition to the ones we discussed before about updating your current policies, is implement a specific BYOD written policy. So if you have a practice right now in place but no written policy, I would strongly suggest getting a written policy as soon as possible. In that policy, you can specify what devices are permitted. You can establish security policy for all devices. So what we talked about before, you can require employees to use strong password protection at the welcome screen level. You can require employees to have a program in place on their phone or their tablet that will automatically lock the device after a few minutes of activity. With regard to security policy, you can also require that the employee report immediately to their wireless carrier and to you if the device is lost or stolen. And you can also require that the employee download a Find My Phone application. So some of you might be familiar with that, but that allows, if you have an, I believe it's Apple product right now, allows Apple to track where your phone's at, even if it's been compromised. Another thing that you can do with a written policy is you can clarify who owns what apps, who owns what data. You can clarify what apps will be allowed or banned. So like you can do now, probably through your internet software at your company prohibiting certain websites, you can prohibit certain applications if they're more likely to result in a corruption of your data or a security breach. You can articulate a clear acceptable use policy, what will and will not be allowed. That really ties in some of the harassment and discrimination concerns. And you can set up an employee exit strategy. So that's another question is, what do you do if somebody is using their personal device and then they're fired or they resign, and now they have all this company information on their personal device and they're trying to walk out the door? That is something that you can address in your written policy. Now, you issue that written policy, and what's the thing that you have to do is get an acknowledgement and consent form and maintain that form. Just like with handbooks, those acknowledgement forms are really important to show that the employee got it, he read it, and he understood it. Another solution that you can implement is on a completely different side, which is technical. Technical solutions are very reassuring to many companies. So this is, again, where that tripart relationship comes into play, where you work with your IT department, you work with your HR department, you work with upper-level management, and you figure out if there's anything technical that you can do to protect yourself. So one thing that's big out there right now that a little bit of research will turn up a lot of results is mobile device management software. And that is something, the pictures sort of show how they work. Between your company data, the person using the phone, and the phone itself. And that software can require encryption of data stored on the device, require, like we talked about, strong passwords for access, and force wipe of device after 10 unsuccessful password attempts. There's several different vendors that provide that management software, and there's several different types of software out there. So if you have a BYOD policy, you can require employees to download the software or to utilize it on their phone, and then you have another layer of protection. The issue there is, of course, cost, so that's why the tripart relationship comes into play. With that said, I wanted to run through some sample policy language. I think this is really important because so often we talk about updating your handbooks, updating your policies. I wanted to give you some black and white language that you might be able to use depending upon your business. You might be able to craft to fit into your policies. As always, you know, feel more than free to contact any one of your Plunkett Cooney attorneys to review and update your policies. But in the interim, I wanted to give you some ideas of what other companies have used and what have been successful and what's been recommended out there. So when you look at this language on the first slide, so the first bullet says, employees may have the opportunity to use their personal electronic devices, including personally owned cell phones, tablets, laptops, and computers for work purposes after receiving written authorization. The use of personal devices is limited to certain employees and may be limited based on technology. Now, this is the first sentence that you could put in a BYOD policy. So you're explaining the policy and explaining who it applies to. The second point, authorized employees shall have antivirus and mobile device management software installed on their personal mobile device. This is something that's going to be company specific. Do you want to do that or do you not want to do that? We go to the next page and we see another prohibition that would protect your security, your data security, which is preventing employees from using cloud-based apps. So again, preventing employees from downloading something on their phone that's going to allow malware to be installed or phishing scams to affect them more easily. Here, we get the privacy statement. No employee should have any expectation of privacy except that which is governed by law. The governed by law clause saves you in the event of a claim or a lawsuit to a certain extent, as long as you're not actually invading the privacy. But putting something like that so it's clear that the employee shouldn't have an expectation that he doesn't have already at law. And again, like we talked about before, put exactly what that means, what you may monitor, how you might monitor it. The next slide talks about what your employees have to do, what their burden is. Put the burden on them somewhat. They have a duty here to protect the personal devices from damage loss, or theft. So it's not completely up to you. You're allowing them to do this. You can also put a bit of a burden on them. And here you indicate that if, for some reason, it's subject to loss or theft, you can selectively wipe it. And then the next slide talks about what the selective wipe will do. So, again, you're clear, so the employee can't say later he didn't know or that you wiped personal information without his consent. Specific and clear. And then the last slide here talks about the exit strategy that we discussed a little bit earlier. Upon termination or resignation of employment, the employee may be asked to produce his or her personal electronic device for inspection. All company data on personal electronic devices will be removed by IT upon termination or resignation of employment. And then lastly, the policy statement that you should have in all of your policies, failure to follow these policies and procedures may result in disciplinary action up to and including termination of employment. The last thing I want to touch on, that there's no slide, but it goes hand in glove in what we've been talking about all day, is training. Policies don't mean much if supervisors and management aren't properly trained. So if you're going to implement a written policy, if you have a BYOD practice in place, make sure that you have training on this and training on it frequently, because this is one area of the law that's going to be evolving constantly. We'll make sure to stay on top of it on our end and to advise you, but on your end, we would strongly suggest making sure that the training is frequent and pretty thorough with regard to these BYOD issues we discussed today. And that concludes my portion of the presentation.
Wow. I don't know about you, but my head's spinning with all the information and just the different pitfalls and traps that might be out there if we don't address some of these issues. And I'm sure that our attendees must have some questions. So at this time, we're going to ask our operator to come back on the line and remind everybody how to ask a question through the question queue, and we'll take your question.
Thank you. If you would like to ask a question, please signal by pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad. If you're using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Again, press star 1 to ask a question. We'll pause for just a moment to allow everyone the opportunity to signal for questions.
While we're waiting for questions to come in, someone did post a question to our board just about the PowerPoint slides. And, yes, we will make those available to you. One of the things that's going on with our website right now is we're in the midst of an update. So give us a couple of days, and we will get that material out to you. There's a link on our website. And if that's more than a couple of days out, we'll try to maybe even PDF that information to our attendees.
We'll take our first question from Deb Rope with Arbor Consulting Group.
Hi, thanks for taking my question. I was just wondering, besides, you know, going through the internet, is there a good place to find sample, like, security policies or mobile device policies? You know, I've went through the internet and gleaned what I could, but do you guys have any recommendations?
My go-to source for policies is SHRM, S-H-R-M, Society of Human Resource Management, I believe it is. Have you checked that website for any policies yet?
Oh, that would be a very good place to check. No, I haven't.
Yeah,
I just kind of did
SHRM.org.
On the website. Yeah, SHRM.org. Okay,
yeah.
Just go right on their website.
Yeah, and they I know if you – when I look for some, you know, some of the hot recommended policy language, because it's changing constantly, SHRM did have information on their website as far as BYOD is concerned. So I'd do a Google search and include SHRM. They have a lot of good sort of go-tos. That would be the place I would start.
Okay, because when I did just a Google search, SHRM didn't come up, but I'll look specifically at their website.
Yeah, and I will, on my end, too, I'll look for something specific to your concern most about security.
Well, the security and the whole BYOD, because, you know, I've written some internally, but I'd like to balance it to see, you know, am I missing something or just what other people would recommend.
Right. Okay, well, I have several policies that I sort of flagged throughout the couple of years I've been looking at this issue. So I will, I'm sure my marketing department has your name and email address. I'll send you the policies I have on my file. And if anybody else is interested in any sort of websites or sample policies, I can send you what we have. The recommendation always is make sure that you talk to an attorney about it before publishing it, just because the stuff changes so frequently. But with that said, I can definitely send you some of the resources that we use at Plunkett Cooney when we're looking to try to make sure our recommendations are up to date.
I'd really appreciate that information. Thank you, Courtney.
No problem. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you would like to ask a question, you may do so by pressing star 1.
You know, Courtney, before our next question comes up, hopefully we have a couple more. If not, that's fine as well. But just the interconnectivity of all these different issues. You know, people are talking about going out and finding sample policies and all that. But I know that I worry, and I know I hear you all as attorneys in the firm talk a lot and have concerns about just how, you know, these different federal and state laws interweave, and the caution that needs to go into thinking about all this stuff is just something that folks really need to pay attention to.
Right, absolutely, especially with regard to security issues as far as privacy is concerned. Security and privacy seem to go hand in hand, and also concerted protective activity. That's not something that I talked about on this during this presentation, but something that you're probably all familiar with as far as the NLRA is concerned, and that you can't prohibit your employees from engaging in concerted protective activities, regardless of whether they're unionized or not. So when you're implementing policies, if you're pulling things from different sources, I think that's always a good starting point, but the final point should be reviewed by an attorney to make sure that they're all cohesive and that one policy doesn't implicate a law where a previous policy was specifically designed not to do just that. So I mean, as far as, you know, touching base and familiarizing yourself with this topic, the Internet has a wealth of information, but an attorney should be the final set of eyes on this at all times.
Okay, do we have any other questions?
We'll take our next question from Brad Bishop with Neighborhood Service Organization.
Hi, Courtney. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks, Brad.
All right. My question is, how does VDI virtual desktop technology help or hurt the BYOD environment?
So you're talking about like a web Citrix or something along those lines that allows an employee to gain access on their own device?
So they would actually log into a virtualized desktop instead of actually having data on their mobile device.
Right. I know at Plunkett Cooney, that's the way that we do it. If I'm to leave the office and to go home, I have to get any sort of work materials I have to access through. We use Web Citrix. I know it's a pretty common platform. I think that helps employers as far as keeping their eyes on what employees are doing. I think one problem is, though, is that employees might feel sort of compelled to save things to their own desktop at times. So I think the policy regarding that is important. Encryption with those programs are important to make sure that the data is secure. I think accessing a secure wireless connection is also important, even if they're accessing a virtual desktop. I think it's still important to make sure that they're not making themselves susceptible to malware or phishing scams through the unsecured wireless connection. And I think the best resource to discuss those issues, those red flags that come to my mind, are IT people. Unfortunately, my training is limited to the legal side of things with a little spattering of technological information here and there, but I would talk to my IT department and see, you know, how secure are we when we're allowing access through virtual desktops, because they're going to be able to tell you how it works and what the risks are. But I think that's definitely one solution a lot of employers have been implementing, because at least it gives them visibility that they may not have had before.
Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for the question.
As a final reminder, if you would like to ask a question, you may do so by pressing star 1. Currently, there are no additional questions in the queue.
Okay, well, thank you very much, everybody. Want to just give you a couple closing thoughts here. Number one, as always, for those of you that have been on some of our other webinars, We're going to obviously send out a survey, post that webinar survey to you. We want your feedback on our program today. I know Courtney covered a lot of information, and we also will get those slides posted for you. Typically, those are posted just prior to the start of our programs, but due to the problem we have with our website upgrade, that wasn't possible. The other thing I wanted to point out to everybody is that our slides and actually the audio for today will be on the website soon. So if you even have colleagues that were not able to join us today, make sure that you point them to our website, and under our events page, they'll be able to access the information. And last but not least, we also have upcoming dates for you to take note of for our webinar series, which continues on September 11th. Working through an EEOC investigation, and I think, Courtney, you're presenting that one as well. And then November 13th, healthcare reform, another big topic, and I believe Gary Francis from our employment practices group is going to be covering that topic. So we invite you all to save the dates on your calendar. We'll keep you posted as we get closer to those as well. So at this point, we're going to thank you and wish you a great rest of the day, and hope to see you soon. And thanks again on behalf of Courtney and Plunkett Cooney's Labor and Employment Practice Group. Thanks for attending.
That does conclude today's conference. Thank you for your participation.